Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Hey, it's Andy, Mike, and Jason of the Fantasy Footballers Podcast here, and we're inviting you to join us live on NFL Plus following the first round of the NFL Draft. Look, fantasy football, let's be honest, gentlemen, it kind of rules the world.
That's right, and we will be live with in-the-moment fantasy football reactions to all the first-round selections and all the craziest surprises. We never can predict what's going to happen on that first day of the NFL draft.
Lots of elite talent at the skill positions that will have a big impact on fantasy football this year. Are we going to get three wide receivers in the top 10? Are we going to break the record for the most wide receivers in the first round? Is there going to be a running back? I don't know.
And there's a lot of teams like the Chiefs, the Bills. We're really excited about their quarterback. Do they add a wide receiver? What are some of those best landing spots?
The Fantasy Footballers Draft Special will air exclusively on NFL Plus on Thursday, April 25th, following the conclusion of the first round of the draft. Go to plus.nfl.com to sign up today. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today, hey, it's the diseases and the heavens. Because, Rob, you recently said, hey, would you be interested in doing an episode or two on the interactions between plague pandemics of the past and God and religious interpretations? And I was like, wow, yeah, that sounds really interesting. But Rob, I got to admit, this is one of those topics where something sounds really interesting, but then as soon as you start getting into it, you realize, oh no, it's one of those where the more I read, the less I know. That is definitely the case with the historical scholarship on religious responses to the plague. It seems like this is a really complicated area of research.
Yes, I'd say a complicated area of research and also a robust and thriving area of research. And I think that's something that it might surprise some listeners out there to know that, like, the Black Death and the study of the Black Death and our attempt to understand things like mortality rates and how it spread and then how people responded to it and its effects short term and long term. You might think that this is a matter of the history books. This is something that has been settled for decades, if not centuries, and there's perhaps very little, like just some fine tuning of the research these days. But it's not the case. There's a lot of work that goes on in this area of study, and there's still exciting stuff coming out.
I mean, you go back a couple decades, and it seems like a lot of what people were arguing about was whether or not plague was caused by plague.
Right. Yeah, and I remember this. I don't think I ever wrote anything specifically for HowStuffWorks.com about the Black Death. Maybe I had to cover it like briefly in some sort of a top 10 pandemics type of an article or something. Mm-hmm. But I remember at the time this being the case where there were these different theories about what it might have been. Was it perhaps this particular ailment or disease? Was it this one? Or was it actually what we think of as bubonic plague?
Yeah, and so at least I think that question is mostly settled. We can give a fairly firm answer on that one today. But I was just surprised how much about the plague pandemics is still up in the air or has been questioned or is still controversial. And how often a fact you thought you knew about it might not actually be correct. But anyway, so I was also wondering, like, how'd you get interested in this? What made you want to talk about the Black Death and the powers of God?
Well, I think part of it was I had picked up Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose again when I was reading through that, and I was reminded about how it's mentioned that Brother William eventually dies in the plague or is lost in the plague, and like knowing that the plague is the thing that comes, the Black Death specifically, is the thing that comes after the events of the novel, and so sometimes that you know makes me think about the world that is described in that book and how it's going to fare against a threat like this.
Hmm.
And then of course it goes without saying, you know, we're recording this, researching this during an ongoing global pandemic, and so I think it's something that has been on a lot of people's minds. A lot of people have turned their minds back to historical plagues. Now, of course, in fighting this pandemic, COVID-19, we have a number of tools not available to humanity during the late Middle Ages. We know what actually causes the illness we're facing. We're able to figure out how it works, and we have both treatments and, most marvelous of all, vaccines that we can use. And speaking of vaccines, go get vaccinated against COVID-19 if you have the ability to do so. And if you're not sure, talk to a medical doctor and find out what you need to know from them.
So obviously there were no vaccines in the time of the Black Death in the 14th century outbreak of the plague, but also there really weren't any treatments. I mean, if you get plague today, we know today that it is a bacterial infection, and if caught early, it can be treated pretty effectively with antibiotics. I mean, back at the time of the Black Death, there really were not effective interventions at all.
Yeah, it's really kind of staggering to think about it, to imagine a time right before the Black Death and just think about what a mismatch this was. Medieval societies versus a deadly, contagious disease caused by an invisible bacterium. The disease, on one hand, you might say, you know, understands its human adversaries to a certain extent, you know, and not that it has a will or an intelligence, but it gets in there and it does its thing. The humans, on the other hand, well, I mean, they have the gift of reason, certainly. They have technology and society, but they lack a germ theory of disease. They don't really know how the enemy, in this case, the Black Death, how it functions or even truly what it is. So they're blind in many ways. And on top of that, they have leaned into a supernatural understanding of the world. They believe in gods and saints and demons and miracles, and they trust in religious organizations and religious authorities, or in many cases, powers that are ordained by religious authorities. Another way of looking at things in this scenario is that in some ways you have humanity stranded between two unseen worlds, the at least partially invisible world of disease and then the invisible world of religion. So, you know, it's like, this is the matchup. How will these religious organizations and authorities respond to the Black Death? What chance do they have? And so in this episode and whatever episode or episodes follow it, I thought we might get into that a little bit and talk about how imperfect societies respond to what is in many ways, you know, a perfect pathogen with a focus on religion. But before we get into the religious stuff, we will have to talk about just like what was the Black Death as far as we understand it.
Okay, well, I guess we should start with that question. What do we think we know today about the nature of this disease?
So, first of all, let's just talk about, like, what do we mean when we mean the Black Death versus, like, other plagues, right? So, historians generally consider the Black Death to have lasted from around 1346 CE, obviously, to 1353 throughout Afro-Eurasia, more or less on the heels of the Great Famine of 1315 through 1317. And this will become important in a bit.
But now, one thing that's important to consider, and this is true of multiple cases of plague pandemic in the world that we'll talk about in just a second, The Black Death as a term is sometimes applied to this sort of initial outbreak that has been widely studied as having happened in, say, like Europe and the Middle East around the Mediterranean, beginning around 1346 or 47, and then continuing for some years after that. But each of these pandemics is not contained to just a few years. There are these recurrent waves.
Yeah.
So there will be an initial wave of infection, and then it just sort of goes away for a while within a certain region. But then there will be subsequent outbreaks throughout different regions over the following centuries, really, in the case of the one that begins in the 14th century. And one of the papers I was looking at was calling these recurrent waves.
Yeah, yeah. So it's important to realize that the Black Death of the 14th century, it's not thought to be the first great outbreak of plague in the Old World. The plague of Justinian occurred between 541 and 549 CE, and it was also not the last pandemic of plague, as major outbreaks would occur throughout the 14th and 17th centuries, including the Great Plague of London in 1665 and 1666. But the 14th century outbreak is what is generally referred to when we talk about the Black Death, a pandemic that claimed the lives of between 75 and 200 million people and reshaped society for the survivors.
I've seen drastically different estimates of what percentage of people within certain regions the Black Death killed. So I think this is not a settled question. It's something mm-hmm. that has to be, you know, it's not like there were just like, there was a census of people and you can chart everyone who died. This is a number that has to be established through estimates.
Right.
But like,
and in some cases you have good data to go on. You know, you can look at essentially death rolls from certain regions and certain time periods. And then some work has been done in examining cemeteries and the like.
Yeah, exactly. So one figure I looked at for the Black Death said that the Black Death and its recurrent waves may have wiped out somewhere between 1/3 to 2/3 of the population of Europe.
Any way you shake it, a lot of people died. I mean, it's any variance in the numbers doesn't really take away from just how brutal this was. Now, one source I was looking at in all of this was the Anthropology of Plague by Sharon N. DeWitt, published in Pandemic Disease in the Medieval World, and this was from 2014. One of the things that DeWitt talks about is the idea that, again, this particular outbreak of plague, the Black Death, is following a period of rapid population growth and plenty due to warm climates and advancements in agriculture. When the warm period ended, however, there were ripples throughout Europe. There was less food. There was famine. There was an abundance of labor under a feudal system. So most people during this time experienced a decline in their standard of living. Non-plague illness and malnutrition was running rampant. And so there's this strong argument to be made that DeWitt writes about at length, that this made them even more susceptible to this new disease or this new outbreak of a disease that had previously ravaged parts of the region.
Yeah, and this has been another major trend in writing over, say, the past 100 years about the Black Death of the 14th century and its recurrent waves. How exactly does that get situated within the broader social, economic, and cultural context of the time which it occurred? What led to it? What exacerbated it? And what changes did it bring about? Because it's widely believed, I guess we're not going to get super deep into these particular historical theories, but there have been a lot of theories about what role the Black Death may have played in, say, revolutionizing the economic history of Europe, and did it in some way trigger changes that might lead to things you associate with the late Middle Ages or the Renaissance?
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, I think it's also one of these things where you look at some of the older scholarship, or if you just look at sort of generalized summaries of the Black Death, you know, it's often pointed out, well, this affected everybody. It didn't matter what level of society you were at. And to a large extent, that is true. I mean, people died at every level of society. And there's this kind of idea that, you know, the Black Death is, you know, you get into these religious ideas of the judgment of humanity. And it seems like it's just everybody is suffering equally. But does that hold up if we start looking at different populations, be it things like population density or dealing with, you know, large portions of the population that are malnourished and so forth?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, here's a quote from DeWitt in that article I mentioned. Quote, "The very high levels of Black Death mortality and the results from hazard analysis, which indicate that this mortality was selective and targeted frail people of all ages, means that the epidemic might have exerted a strong selective force on the northern population, removing the frailest, unhealthiest individuals on a very large scale. If the post-Black Death population included individuals who were exposed to and survived the Black Death, this episode of selection might, at least in part, explain the very rapid apparent changes in medieval plague epidemiology. These changes include the apparent decline in plague mortality as described in contemporaneous historical documents."
Okay, so what's she getting at there?
She's getting into this, you know, this idea that, okay, so the plague hits, it wipes out a lot of people that at all levels of society and all ages that may have been extra susceptible to the ravages of the disease. But then afterwards, you perhaps have a certain resistance in the survivors. But then she also points out that, on the other hand, patterns of human plague deaths might reflect the disease dynamics of nearby animal host populations, which can influence exposure of humans to plague, and we'll get into more of like what that means later about the disease dynamics and animal hosts. But it also might mean that survivors were in better shape to survive the plague and or had better access to nutrition or standard of living in the years after the Black Death had really ravaged the population.
Mm-hmm.
Because after the Black Death, there's this idea that you ultimately end up with a potentially more sustainable population, potentially an improved gene pool with possible resistance to the plague. The feudal system was weakened by all of this, potentially paving the way for further changes. This is a direction a lot of the scholarship goes in. Yeah, what does it do to the world that allows a certain amount of rapid change to take place, or introduces new changes that could occur at the socioeconomic level, et cetera. Of course, on the other hand, I think we have to be careful about getting into that, that sort of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger idea that, like, you know, the plague was good. It strengthened everybody up and made a better world because, in the words of Conan O'Brien, what doesn't kill you almost kills you. So it was still a period of great suffering and death. I mean, to an extent that it's difficult to imagine. And of course, that is going to have an effect on the survivors that goes beyond just, you know, any kind of like fitness that results, any kind of resistance to illness or an improvement in your access to a higher standard of living.
Right. So you shouldn't be lured into thinking like, oh, well, if after the plague, the people who were left tended to have a higher resistance to disease and there may have been some economic benefits for them. That doesn't mean like the plague was a good thing.
Right. Right. And I mean, plus there's a lot of great data on just how events of this nature. I mean, there is a lasting effect of, say, malnutrition on on one's descendants, that sort of thing. So to be clear, plague bad, plague very bad.
I think that is one of the firm facts we can say. Consensus on that. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included.
Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, what was the plague? Well, as we mentioned earlier, there were various alternative theories and hypotheses. I mean, I guess there still technically are alternative theories and hypotheses, but none of them have enough support to rival the now commonly agreed upon understanding that the plague in question was bubonic plague caused by the plague bacterium Yersinia pestis.
Yeah. So it seems like in the late 20th and early 21st century, there was some of this academic debate about the infectious agent driving the Black Death. But yeah, I agree. It does seem like it is a pretty firm matter of consensus now that the Black Death beginning in the 14th century was caused by Yersinia pestis. And that bacterium, that bacillus, is something that we've known about since the year 1894, when it was discovered, I think, by two different researchers pretty much simultaneously. One was Kitasato Shibasaburo of Japan, and the other was Alexander Yersin of France. So I think from his name, Yersin, you get Yersinia, the genus name of the bacterium that causes the plague. And so this was around the year 1894, which was also the time of the 1894 Hong Kong outbreak of plague, which was a major part of the third plague pandemic. You mentioned that there have been three major plague pandemics in history that we know about: the plague of Justinian, beginning in the 6th century, then the Black Death beginning in the 14th century, and then this more recent one from the 19th and 20th century.
Right. And there's been some other stuff sprinkled around in there as well. But those are the big ones. Now, Yersinia pestis, as the CDC points out, it has a place in nature, even in the modern world, even in North America. Yersinia pestis is transmitted by fleas to a variety of rodents. These rodents certainly include the rat, but they also include squirrels, chipmunks, voles, and rabbits. This situation is relatively stable, it's thought, with the bacteria circulating at low rates and without excessive mortality, again, in these rodent populations.
Yeah, so as with a number of zoonotic diseases, humans are not the natural host of this bacterium, Yersinia pestis. Yersinia pestis lives in this natural cycle. I think it's sometimes called the Sylvan cycle, traveling between the bodies of fleas and small mammals, generally rodents like rats, like you say. And then the bacteria multiply within the gut of the flea. And then when the flea bites a rat host to suck its blood, it sort of spits up some of the infectious bacteria in its gut into the rat and can infect a new rat host. But of course, sometimes infectious microbes can jump from their natural host species to another, like humans, and this is where you get zoonotic diseases like plague. I was actually reading an article in Scientific American, I think it wasn't originally in SciAm, it was a reprint from Quanta, but it was by an author named Kerry Arnold from 2015 that was covering a study published in Nature Communications in 2015 about the evolution of this bacterium, of Yersinia pestis, which causes the plague. And the paper was by Zimbler et al. Called Early Emergence of Yersinia pestis as a Severe Respiratory Pathogen. And so the authors were looking into the question of where did Yersinia pestis come from and how did it become so virulent? And so they write in their abstract as follows. We showed that the acquisition of a single gene encoding the protease PLA, I'm not sure if that's pronounced play or pla, but it's PLA. PLA was sufficient for the most ancestral deeply rooted strains of Y. pestis to cause pneumonic plague, and we'll get more into the different varieties in a moment, indicating that Y. pestis was primed to infect the lungs at a very early stage in its evolution. As Y. pestis further evolved, modern strains acquired a single amino acid modification within PLA that optimizes protease activity. While this modification is unnecessary to cause pneumonic plague, the substitution is instead needed to efficiently induce the invasive infection associated with the bubonic plague. These findings indicate that Y. pestis was capable of causing pneumonic plague before it evolved to optimally cause invasive infections in mammals. So pneumonic plague, the version in the lungs, is as we'll explain in a bit, the most deadly form of Yersinia pestis infection. But it has probably existed longer than the bubonic form of infection. But once the bacterium evolved the ability to cause the bubonic plague, the main version of the disease associated with the Black Death, the disease function of this bacterium was, in a sense, probably optimized for maximum infectious potential. And then this article by Kerry Arnold quotes a microbiologist from Northern Arizona University at Flagstaff named Paul Keim, who mentions that with Yersinia pestis, quote, a single bacterium can cause disease in mice. It's hard to get much more virulent than that. And so that's an incredibly infectious agent. That's, if you're trying to set up like a thunderdome of bacteria, it seems like Yersinia pestis could be a sort of infecting champion if a single bacterium can cause this disease.
Wow, yeah. So like we said, the idea is in the natural model, it's just Yersinia pestis and these rodents. But then these complications occur. So for starters, sometimes for different reasons, the death rate in the desired rodent host population goes up and the fleas have to go somewhere else. And other times you have, you know, people coming into close contact with these animals, with these fleas, and we see these spreading events occur. And the flea still has to feed, so it might move on to other animals, including domestic animals and ultimately human beings as well. Now, humans can acquire it from handling the bodies and pelts of infected animals. Dogs are apparently less likely to become ill, but can still bring the fleas into close proximity with human beings. Interestingly enough, cats typically become very ill with it, and they can also directly infect humans through their cough if they have the plague.
Did you see anything? I feel like I saw a headline somewhere recently about an outbreak of plague among mountain lions in North America. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I did not see that article, but based on this information about cats, it sounds like it could be very destructive.
Okay, yeah, I just checked. I was remembering this right. This was from a couple of articles from April of last year in 2020 that found that in Yellowstone National Park in the United States, there has been an outbreak of plague that has been killing cougars in the park.
Oh, wow.
Strangely, this does kind of connect to some stuff I've read about. So it's pretty rare for people to get plague in the United States today, but it does happen. And sometimes some of the cases I've read about it happening were from contact people had with animals in parks, in like wildlife refuges.
Yeah, yeah. Close proximity to these animals definitely is one of the driving forces in those spreads. Now we should stress that with these modern outbreaks, generally they do not spread as fast, and then ultimately we're better able to treat these infections today. But yes, to be clear, the way plague tends to spread to human beings, it includes flea bites, contact with contaminated fluids and tissues, and infectious droplets.
And this sort of goes along with that there are three main different versions of the disease. So they're all caused by the same bacterium. They're all Yersinia pestis. But depending on how you get infected, you can have different manifestations of disease within your body. And the most common version is the one you probably read about in school. It's the bubonic plague, the one that begins with probably some kind of bite from a parasite like a flea in the skin, and then can eventually infect the lymph nodes. It causes swelling of the lymph nodes. You get these bulbs known as buboes, and this also comes with like very severe flu-like symptoms. But then there are these other less common versions of the plague disease that have their own characteristics, such as septicemic plague, which comes from an infection of the blood, and pneumonic plague, which is an infection of the lungs. And that one is, from everything I read, pneumonic plague is the worst one of all.
Yeah, I mean, there are varying infection stats I was looking at on the three, and it kind of depends, I think, on who you're looking at, but certainly. Yes, certainly the pneumonic plague is pretty bad.
But I guess one question this gets us to is the question of what are the mechanisms of transmission? How was the plague actually spread, especially in these giant outbreaks and pandemics from long ago?
Yeah, so the way it's spreading, you're going to have different speeds involved, right? So the speed at which it tends to spread when it's based on flea transference is going to be different than the way it seems to spread if it's based on droplets in the air, people coughing in close proximity to one another. So you read some of these various ideas about what was happening with the Black Death. How was plague spreading? And one idea that you see is that, well, perhaps it was spreading rapidly because it was primarily due to these droplets, and it was a largely pneumatic plague that was really wiping people out. And if that were true, it would kind of be ironic, I guess, because what do we think of when we think of plague? We often think of plague doctors, right? We think of those those outfits with the big robe and the long bird-like beak and the big hat and the staff. The idea being that it's, to lift garments, but also perhaps to distance yourself from someone else. However, always worth remembering that the plague doctor outfits and masks, I do not believe were introduced until later in the 17th century.
Yeah.
And so even if this was a design that was out there, and there's some disagreement on how much it was actually used, but it certainly would not have been used during the Black Death itself. It would have been subsequent plagues.
Well, yeah, it would be some of the recurrent waves from that ongoing pandemic that began in the 14th century.
Right. And then, of course, the other question would be, well, would it have worked, Well, ultimately, the design of those later plague doctor masks, it was more about purifying bad air and keeping bad air from touching your skin. So, you could make a case for it might have helped in some ways, but not for the reasons present in the design,
Yeah, one thing that's kind of difficult to understand, I've been reading about this, for example, in one paper looking at recent scholarship comparing the responses of religious communities of Christians, Muslims, and Jews around the Mediterranean at the time, and what, for example, the question of like what they thought about the idea of contagion. You know, was contagion within the epidemiological vocabulary of people at the time? And it seems like, to even though they didn't have a germ theory of disease, like they didn't understand fully that diseases were being caused by tiny, you know, life forms that were replicating within their bodies, there were some people who had some form of an idea of contagion, though the transmission mechanism itself might have been obscure to them. There were people who thought like, well, you can observe that plague tends to proliferate within a building. So people within a house, then everybody else in the house starts to get plague. And then if you go to a place where there's a lot of plague, you're more likely to get plague. And so that might have been explained in terms of something like miasma theory, where you might think, well, there are just bad vapors around there. And if they get into you, maybe if you breathe them or they get on your skin, those will harm you. But I think there was also an idea that maybe sometimes sick people have some kind of particles coming off of them, and you want to prevent those particles from touching you. And so this might have inspired some of these full body coverings you see with the plague doctor outfits, that you know, you would have big coverings that might have been covered in some kind of waxy substance or something to try to really keep stuff out. And then you tuck it all in, like you tuck your shirt in and you tuck your gloves in and everything to kind of just prevent stuff from getting on you. And even if they didn't have a germ theory of disease, that in itself might have been quite useful in keeping out various vectors of infection that we can talk about in a second.
Yeah. But then again, you can also use some of the same logic to then to make judgments like, well, plague is here. I don't want plague. We should all go over here, and then we'll be safe. So ultimately, without really knowing your enemy in this case, really knowing what it is you're up against and sort of the rules that it adheres to, you know, there's still a lot of guesswork involved. And sometimes you're kind of accidentally, or maybe not quite accidentally, I mean, making leaps based on logic, getting to some level of understanding about what you're dealing with and how disease works, but in other cases, missing it.
Yeah, that's right. And it still seems like there is actually still a good bit of scientific controversy over what are the primary routes of transmission for plague at various times and places. The sources I've been looking at, so it seems like the more classical understanding was that people were mostly infected with plague by proximity to what are called commensal rodents. Commensal comes from, I think, the term for sharing a table together, sharing meals together, that commensal rodents would be like rats living in or near your house, and that those rats would get plague-infected fleas on them, and then from the rats, the fleas would jump to humans and bite them, and those bites would develop into bubonic plague. And then, of course, sometimes bubonic plague can turn into pneumonic plague. So you can have, so this is a little confusing, but you can have primary pneumonic plague, where the infection route is inhaled droplets that infect the lungs. So if somebody like coughs pneumonic plague and then you inhale it, you can get primary pneumonic plague. Or you can have secondary pneumonic plague, where you're at first infected with the common form of the disease, the bubonic plague, and then that progresses in the body and develops into the lung infection, into pneumonic plague, and then you can spread it to others through droplets, through coughing or whatever. And of course, the people who got it that way would have primary pneumonic plague. And again, pneumonic plague is extremely deadly. And in fact, to introduce a study I was going to mention next, so there was a study published in PNAS in 2018 by Catherine R. Dean et al., called Human Ectoparasites and the Spread of Plague in Europe During the Second Pandemic. And the authors there writing about the different forms of plague, they write that, quote, secondary pneumonic plague develops in an estimated 20% of bubonic cases. And this creates potential for primary pneumonic spread, even if it is not the dominant transmission route. So they're not saying that the plague was primarily spread via droplets coughed by people who had pneumonic plague, but that can be one way that the plague spreads. So maybe like 20% of the people who get bubonic plague eventually end up with pneumonic plague, and then when they're coughing, it's going all over the place. But anyway, I wanted to talk about this study itself by Dean et al. From 2018, because this offered some evidence based on epidemiological modeling to try to solve the question of what was the primary route of transmission for plague in various places and times. So there's this consensus that, yes, the Black Death was caused by Yersinia pestis, primarily manifesting in the bubonic plague form. And this is backed up by multiple lines of evidence, including DNA analysis of remains from places like plague cemeteries. But there are still these remaining questions about which route of transmission was the most responsible for the horrible outbreaks we see chronicled in Europe, Africa, and Asia. Now, just once again, some of the previously known major ways that a person could become infected with plague would be, first of all, being bitten directly by a flea from a disease-carrying rat. And then the second would be inhaling droplets from a person infected with the pneumonic version of the disease. But there are some reasons for doubting either of these methods was the primary route of transmission for most plague infection in the second pandemic. And I think some of these doubts come in the form of a lack of direct evidence. For example, the authors here say that, you know, if you were to have a lot of plague coming directly from rats to humans, you would probably expect to see physical remains indicating huge rat die-offs, what they called rat falls. And they say that we don't actually have that. And then the other thing is circumstantial analysis. Like, the spread of plague was often very rapid in a way that the authors argue can be difficult to explain given either one of the preceding vectors. So, say, directly from rats to humans or droplets from the pneumonic plague. And one problem with spread via the pneumonic plague is actually that people with pneumonic plague tend to get very sick and die extremely fast, and this actually limits its transmission. A disease that kills its host very, very quickly can actually be less likely to spread because it's so deadly.
Right, and this is something that's been driven home about the current pandemic with COVID-19, is that it doesn't kill people off immediately. It allows for this kind of spread, and that's one of the reasons we're in the place we are now.
But in this paper, the authors here explore a third alternative, which they didn't invent. This is something that has been hypothesized and debated in previous research. But they're exploring and trying to model this third alternative, which is human-to-human transmission through the intercession of human ectoparasites. These would be things like fleas and lice, but not jumping off of an infected rat and biting a human and then infecting them. Instead, specific human ectoparasites like human fleas or Pulex irritans or human body lice known as Pediculus humanus humanus. And so the idea here would be that there might be some initial infection case that would come from a wild animal reservoir, but then once it is in humans, human ectoparasites, like the fleas and lice living on human bodies, would bite the infected human and then carry the infection and then go bite another human and infect them. So the primary responsibility would look more like a human-to-human direct spread versus something that is mediated by a rat reservoir.
So we're basically talking about an all new loop that develops, like not the rat and rat parasite loop, but a human and human parasite loop.
Right. And I want to be very clear that this one study here does not mean like the question is settled and it was definitely the human ectoparasites. I think there's still a lot of open questions and plenty of room for debate about what were the main transmission vectors in these different places and times during the second plague pandemic. But the authors here at least found as one line of evidence in favor of the human ectoparasites hypothesis, this evidence was they ran simulations of epidemics based on the three different transmission vectors and what could be known about them, about like how fast you would expect them to spread and what the mortality would be and all that. So they created these mathematical models for spread by primarily pneumonic droplets, people getting pneumonic plague and then coughing and infecting other people, and then flea bites directly from rats, and then spread via human ectoparasites. And they compared these models together. together based on existing data about mortality rates from 9 known locations of plague outbreak in Europe during the second pandemic. And according to their model, the human ectoparasite spread fit the data better than the other methods of spread did. So they think this is one good line of evidence that the primary way plague was spread at this time was via these human ectoparasites. It was human to human, but primarily from little things getting on you that bite you and then jump to another person and bite them. And even if few people, so again, we don't know that this is correct, but it's an interesting idea, and it makes me think about how even though few, if any, people would have understood the vectors of the disease in this way at the time, it does make me think about how if you read plague treatises and people writing about the plague at the time, I recall a lot of things mentioning clothes. Like infected clothes and bed clothes of the deceased, and the idea of, you know, touching the things they wore and all that being dangerous. And that makes me wonder if I'm remembering that right. I mean, that does make me wonder if there is in a way something people are picking up about places where you might expect to find the ectoparasites of infected people.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, on the other hand, if these were people suffering from extreme flu-like symptoms, it also might make sense to steer clear of their garments and their sheets and so forth,
right?
For other reasons, because of potential fluids and whatnot. Now, I saw some coverage of this particular study. I think one of them had a headline that was essentially something like "Rats are off the hook for the Black Death."
Come on.
Do you think that's fair?
I mean, I guess I get halfway fair if you're trying to be cute. I mean, of course, given the understanding that it's not just like one study and then you're done with the subject, like, you know, you're building a base of knowledge and you'd see how this would compare to other lines of evidence for and against the idea. But even then, I think it wouldn't be fully rats are off the hook because if I'm understanding this idea correctly, I think it would still be the idea that there is, of course, a natural rodent reservoir and this is where Yersinia pestis lives in its standard cycle, its cycle in the wild. And so at some point, the jump would have had to happen. You would just say that rats are not primarily the thing carrying it to each person who gets infected.
Right.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it.
I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So it seems like we know second plague pandemic almost definitely was Yersinia pestis, hitting people primarily in the bubonic disease form. There are a lot of interesting, still as yet unsettled questions out there about it, how exactly it worked and research goes on.
Yeah, and there's so many different factors when you start looking at, you know, what causes plague epizootics and outbreaks. You have so many different factors to take into account, like high rates of death among reservoir rodent species, climate related factors. You know, cooler summers following wet winters, that seems to be a factor as well that I've seen highlighted. And then you can also throw in things like high density human populations, multiple rodent types living within that population and so forth. But one of the big questions that often comes up is, okay, well, where did it actually come from? Which, you know, in some ways that's a loaded question, because like I say, you can in North America, you can essentially like wander out into the wilderness and there will be plague somewhere out there. There are rodent reservoirs, all over the place for it. But in terms of like this particular outbreak of the Black Death, there's been a lot written on it. I was reading Was the Black Death in India and China by George D. Sussman. And this was published in the Bulletin of the History of Medicine in 2011. And in it, the author first explores some of the early understandings about the geographic origins of the affliction and then moves on into other areas. So There was apparently an understanding in the 14th century, evident in the writings of 14th century Italian lawyer Gabriel de Musis, that the Black Death had struck throughout the known world, that it was an international crisis, perhaps of biblical proportions, and it was hitting places so far away that they were almost mythical, that even those places were struggling with plague. And then he goes on to mention, so a lot of the scholarship that we have comes from the Christian and the Islamic worlds. He goes on to mention 14th century poet Ibn al-Wardi, who was situated, I believe, in Aleppo, which is in modern-day Syria. And he spoke with merchants who had traveled and observed the plague elsewhere, and he himself would die of the plague in 1349. But he wrote that the pandemic had begun in northern Asia in what he called the Land of Darkness. Quote, China was not preserved from it, nor could the strongest fortress hinder it. The plague afflicted the Indians in India. It weighed upon the Sindh. It seized with its hand and ensnarled even the land of the Uzbeks. How many backs did it break in what is Transoxiana? That, by the way, is an ancient name for Lower Central Asia. And then he continues, the plague increased and spread further. But of course, as we'll discuss here, you know, this was a time during which there was no germ theory of disease. This bit from Al-Wardi comes close to capturing the feel of an actual pandemic, but there's obviously something lacking here, and it would be lacking for some time in human attempts to understand the Black Death's origins. Now, Sussman points to German medical historian J.F.C. Hecker, and he writes in 1832 of it extending out of China, but he links this to a number of alleged events in this part of the world around 1333, things like earthquakes and locusts, a falling meteor, and he then goes on to discuss it in very much the sort of context of miasma theory. He describes it as a, quote, a progressive infection of zones, both above and below the Earth's surface that sweeps east to west. So again, not an understanding of something that will travel from person to person or via rodents or anything like we know now, but rather a kind of bad air fallout sweeping across Eurasia.
And in the absence of other types of explanations, you could see how that would make a lot of sense. I mean, it could pretty neatly match the observed history of the progression of the disease.
Yeah. Now, Sussman eventually concludes that the Black Death might not have visited China or India during the 14th century. And again, I mean, we can't say with 100% degree of certainty. He just says that it seems like this might have been not been the case, though it would hit China and India in later centuries. There's a great deal of European-focused material on plague, as well as a tradition of saying that it emerged in China. And it seems like the third plague pandemic of the 1800s may have began there, but it's hard to trace the second plague pandemic, the Black Death, with 100% accuracy. European and Middle Eastern epidemics can be traced to Crimea in 1346, but before that, it's hard to say. Accounts vary from in or near China to the Mongolian steppe to Central Asia. I've seen Kurdistan and Iraq brought up in an older paper, I think from 1977 by Norris. So at any rate, it remains disputed, though you'll find science headlines, especially from around 2010, that say things like the origins of the Black Death trace back to China, gene sequencing has revealed. But in this, they're tracing it back 2,000 years to the region, which, if accurate, would position it as the cause of the Justinian plague more specifically. And what they ultimately say in that study is in or near China, which covers a wide area of Asia. But again, you'll often find write-ups of plague where they'll say, oh, it originated in China, or it originated in Mongolia, or it originated in Central Asia. And like we said, that's one of the things about diving into research of the Black Death is you go into it thinking that there are certain really just hardcore knowns. There's some solid pillars in this house of research, and some are, but some are not nearly as solid as you think.
You know, Rob, the whole reason you brought this up was so we could talk about religious responses to the second plague pandemic. We haven't even gotten there yet, and I think we might have to call episode one right here and come back and dive into those religious responses in the next episode.
I believe so, but we're off to a good start. I think we've highlighted what the adversary is, and in the next we'll see what the religious authorities did and tried to do to deal with it, or allowed or permitted, etc. So it should be a fun discussion. All right. In the meantime, if you would like to write in about this episode or any other episode, do so. Get in touch with us.
Yeah, yeah. Are you a microbiologist who works with Yersinia pestis? Do you want to tell us all about it? Write on in.
Yeah, we would be delighted to hear from you. If you want to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you'll find them in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed with core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, listener mail on Monday, an artifact on Wednesday, and on Fridays we do a little Weird House Cinema. That's our time just to talk about a particular weird movie, and then we run a rerun over the weekend.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. We'll be right back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today. Health Aid kombucha.
Hey, it's Andy, Mike, and Jason of the Fantasy Footballers Podcast here, and we're inviting you to join us live on NFL Plus following the first round of the NFL Draft. Look, fantasy football, let's be honest, gentlemen, it kind of rules the world.
That's right, and we will be live with in-the-moment fantasy football reactions to all the first-round selections and all the crazy surprises. We never can predict what's going to happen on that first day of the NFL draft.
Lots of elite talent at the skill positions that will have a big impact on fantasy football this year. Are we going to get three wide receivers in the top 10? Are we going to break the record for the most wide receivers in the first round? Is there going to be a running back? I don't know.
And there's a lot of teams like the Chiefs, the Bills. We're really excited about their quarterback. Do they add a wide receiver? What are some of those best landing spots?
The Fantasy Footballers Draft Special will air exclusively on NFL Plus on Thursday, April 25th, following the conclusion of the first round of the draft. Go to plus.nfl.com to sign up today. Terms and conditions apply.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.